Welcome to the Verity Podcast for Saturday, April 20th, 2024, where we separate the spin from the facts. I'm Scott Wallace.
And I'm Eric Steiner. Here's a look at today's top stories. Israel reportedly conducts a limited counterattack against Iran.
While the U.S. vetoes a Palestinian push for full U.N. membership.
A man tragically self-immolates outside of Donald Trump's New York trial.
A Polish man is arrested over an alleged Russian plot to assassinate Volodymyr Zelensky.
U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson proposes a $95 billion foreign aid bill.
The U.S. resumes deportation of Haitian migrants.
108 students are arrested at a pro-Palestinian protest at Columbia University.
Peter Morrell is charged with embezzlement in a Scottish National Party probe.
A study reports that almost a quarter of all United Kingdom kids under 7 own smartphones.
And Meta is rolling out new AI chatbots across its platforms.
In our top story, according to recent reports, Israel conducts limited counterstrikes on an Iranian territory. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, Voice of America, NPR Online News, Al Jazeera, and Fox News. Iranian officials have provided differing accounts of explosions heard early Friday morning, local time, in Isfahan, Iran, with some saying Tehran repelled a limited drone strike by Israel and others refusing to acknowledge the incident. Israel has not officially commented, while U.S. officials have told media outlets that Israel conducted a limited counterstrike to Iran's previous attack, with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urging restraint in the region. Meanwhile, Iranian state media has been downplaying the incident, asserting the security of Isfahan's nuclear facilities and returning the air traffic, suspended early morning, back to normal. Details of Israel's alleged strikes, such as scale and weapons used, are currently unknown. The International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, has determined that Iran's nuclear facilities are unharmed following the incident. Regional tensions have heightened since Iran's retaliation to Israel's April 1st airstrike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. So far, some geopolitical analysts are viewing the situation as a, quote, limited exchange, with Iran indicating it will not retaliate further. According to military officials speaking to Fox News, Israel allegedly alerted the Biden administration ahead of the attack, but Washington did not endorse the operation or play any part in its execution.
Thanks, Eric. On this show, we separate the spin from the facts. Our first narrative spin comes from Business Insider, and it's a pro-establishment narrative. Israel's reported response to Iran's unacceptable strike on Saturday was more limited than many anticipated. But the message to Tehran was obvious. Jerusalem can breach Iran's air defenses and attack its nuclear sites whenever it wants. Thursday's operation demonstrates that both sides are capable of causing significant harm to the other, and we may be witnessing the beginning of a return to deterrence and more prudent geopolitical calculation.
The establishment critical narrative comes from Truth Out. Iran's military action against Israel on April 14th was based on Article 51 of the UN Charter, which guarantees the legitimate right to self-defense, and was in reaction to Israel's deadly attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. Israel blatantly violated international law when it struck Iran on Thursday. However, due to its restricted scope, it does not require an immediate response. It's not in Iran's interest to further escalate the conflict, and it's Tehran who is modeling a, quote, rules-based order, rather than Israel and its Western allies.
And from time to time, we have statistics-based nerd narratives brought to us by the Metaculous Prediction Community. This one says there's a 40% chance that Iran will recognize Israel before the year 2070. The U.S. vetoes a Palestinian push for full U.N. membership. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Times of Israel, New York Times, Reuters, The New Arab, UN News, and The Guardian. The U.S. vetoed a Palestinian request to the UN Security Council for full UN membership on Thursday, effectively blocking the world body from recognizing a Palestinian state. The draft resolution issued by Algeria recommended that the state of Palestine be admitted to membership to the UN. 12 of the 15-member UNSC voted in favor, while the UK and Switzerland abstained. Israeli UN Ambassador Gilad Erdan welcomed the U.S. move as a decision for truth and morality in the face of hypocrisy in politics, claiming Palestinians failed to meet the necessary UN membership criteria. The Office of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the U.S. veto against the draft submitted by Algeria, calling it an aggression that pushes the Middle East further to the edge of the abyss. The U.S. veto comes as Palestine, a permanent observer to the UN since 2012, filed a request with the UN Secretary General in early April, asking for a 2011 bid to join the UN to be reconsidered. Addressing the UNSC, UN Chief Antonio Guterres called for lasting peace between Israel and a fully independent Palestinian state. Full membership requires the Council and two-thirds of the General Assembly to agree.
Thanks, God, for the facts. Jerusalem Post is going to start our round of spins. It's a pro-establishment narrative. Palestinian statehood can only be achieved through direct Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Apart from that, the Palestinian Authority failed to implement the reforms necessary for the U.S. not to veto. Meanwhile, Gaza, an essential part of a possible Palestinian state, is ruled by the Hamas terror group. Peaceful coexistence cannot be dictated. And as long as Palestinian leaders support Hamas and refuse to recognize Israel's right to exist, there will be no Palestinian state.
And the establishment critical narrative comes from Common Dreams. That the U.S. was the only UNSC member to veto the draft once again exposes its alleged full support for a two-state solution as empty talk. Yet it's the U.S. and the U.K. that are primarily responsible for the Middle East's mess through their century of interference and imperialism. Not only do two-thirds of UN members already recognize the state of Palestine, but granting it UN membership and a two-state solution is the only path to peace for both sides.
And the nerds of Metaculus say there is a 34% chance that Israel will recognize Palestine by 2070. The latest in the Trump Manhattan trial, a man self-immolates outside the courthouse. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Le Monde, Intelligencer, NBC, Associated Press, Guardian, and Newsweek. Just after all jurors had been selected in former President Donald Trump's hush money trial in Manhattan, a man lit himself on fire outside the courthouse located on 100 Center Street as police rushed to the scene. The graphic self-immolation was captured on video and shared on social media. Witnesses say the man threw pamphlets into the air before lighting the fire at Collect Pond Park, and a witness said that she had seen the man protesting the trial all week. Police rushed to the scene after being called at 1:37 p.m. local time, putting out the fire while an ambulance rushed the man, who was in critical condition, to a local hospital. A witness saw the man scream before the fire and said police arrived in roughly 1 minute. The court was dismissed for a break right as the fire broke out. Opening statements are slated for Monday morning. The New York Police Department identified the man as Maxwell Azzarello during a press briefing outside the courthouse. He is currently in the Weill Cornell Burn Unit. Before the incident, Azzarello held a sign outside the court that included a link to a Substack site. A letter titled, quote, "I have set myself on fire outside the Trump trial," appeared on the site. And the man says his actions are in protest of, quote, "an apocalyptic fascist world coup."
Thanks, Eric, for those startling facts. We have some narrative spins even on this story. The first one is Narrative A from The Independent. It is clear that anyone who is willing to self-immolate has a serious and tragic mental illness, and it appears that the man who lit himself on fire outside of Trump's trial had succumbed to dangerous conspiracy theories, as shown by his Substack post. This is a tragedy, spotlighting the need to provide mental health support across society.
Newsweek has Narrative B. This was a tragic and desperate act of political protest. Very few are willing, or perhaps allowed, to get to the bottom of the issues that have plagued the global order for decades. Harm to oneself or to others is never acceptable, but this doesn't take away from the deep concerns many people have about our deteriorating human condition.
A Polish man is arrested over an alleged Russian plot to assassinate Zelensky. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by Sky News, BBC News, the Associated Press, and The Guardian. A Polish man, identified only as Paul K., was this week arrested after local authorities alleged he was part of a Russian plot to assassinate Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. In a statement from the Office of Poland's National Prosecutor on Thursday, the man was accused of being prepared to pass airport security information from the Rzeszów Jasionka Airport in southeastern Poland to Russian agents. According to reports, the airport, which lies near Poland's southeastern border with Ukraine, is under U.S. military control and operates as a gateway for the humanitarian and military aid into Ukraine, as well as a hub for international leaders traveling in and out of the country. The statement from the Polish prosecutor added that the arrest was the result of a tip-off. Security services of Ukraine further stated they provided crucial evidence and that they continue to assist in an ongoing investigation. If found guilty, the man faces a maximum jail sentence of 8 years. News of the Polish arrest came hours after prosecutors in Germany also said they made arrests in connection with alleged Russian intelligence operations. In a statement, German officials said they arrested two German-Russian dual nationals on suspicion of surveilling U.S. military facilities and other sites in Germany. The two men, identified only as Dieter S. and Alexander J., are accused of identifying targets for arson and attacks, as well as sharing photos and other intelligence with a Russian agent. Berlin's foreign ministry on Thursday summoned the Russian ambassador in the capital for a meeting.
Thanks, Scott. Let's take a look at the spins. The first one is a pro-establishment narrative coming from CNN. It's only thanks to the diligent work of Polish, Ukrainian, and German intelligence officials that these heinous and unacceptable Russian plots were discovered. Nonetheless, these are grave escalations by Russia, and they are utmostly condemned.
And the pro-Russia narrative from TASS. If Russia wanted to assassinate Zelensky, why not do it on the dozens of occasions he takes pictures with troops on the front lines in Ukraine? If Russia's enemies believe the country is foolish enough to stage such an attack to achieve its wider military aims, those enemies have bad news coming.
And the nerds say there's a 24% chance that Ukraine will join the EU before 2030. That's coming from Metaculus.
Eric, at this point, if Zelensky got assassinated, I think he would probably become a major martyr, right? It'd probably do more harm than good for the Russian cause.
Oh, yeah, probably so. And you know what? His autograph that I have would go
way up.
Way
through
up.
The roof.
Oh,
yep.
Through the roof, yeah. House Speaker Johnson proposes a $95 billion foreign aid bill. The facts are agreed upon by Fox News, Wall Street Journal, CBS, New York Post, and Guardian. The U.S. House voted 316-94 on Friday to send Speaker Mike Johnson's proposed $95 billion foreign aid and military package to the floor for an official vote. Votes in favor, including 165 Democrats and 151 Republicans. The bill for Ukraine is worth about $60 billion, of which $15.8 billion is tabled for security assistance, such as weapons and training. $20.5 billion is for the broader European command operations, and $13.4 billion is to replenish U.S. stockpiles. And you can't forget about those forgivable loans to Kyiv, and that comes in at $9.5 billion. Another bill would give $26.4 billion to Israel, $9.1 billion of which is set for humanitarian assistance per the Democrats' request. Another bill consists of $8.1 billion to counter China in the Indo-Pacific region, including billions for Taiwan. The fourth and final bill in the package includes more sanctions on Russia, as well as taking $5 billion in frozen Russian assets and giving them to Ukraine. This bill also includes sanctions on Iranian oil shipments and other Iran-backed groups such as Hamas. The chamber-wide procedural vote came after the Rules Committee approved the package Thursday night, while right-leaning Republicans Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, Ralph Norman, Republican of South Carolina, and Chip Roy, Republican of Texas, voted against it. Democrats took Johnson's side. The bills will go to the House floor on Saturday for debate and amendment votes. While 55 Republicans voted against it, senior Democrats seem in its favor. Massie has now signed on to Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to oust Speaker Johnson.
Thanks, Eric. We have a pro-establishment narrative from Wall Street Journal. Mike Johnson is finally ignoring this small group of dissident Republicans to pass legislation that most lawmakers and their constituents want. This group began their case by asking for reasonable procedural changes to keep the speaker from having too much power. But now they're using the same tyranny of the minority tactics to block America from defending its allies against terrorists and dictators. The country will now get its long-desired security legislation.
An anti-war comes back with the establishment critical narrative. There are no political parties in America, just a corrupt group of warmongering neocons with neoliberal ideology obsessed with creating wars via unaffordable legislation. Not only will this bill push U.S. debt closer to the estimated $140 trillion by the year 2054, but it's also absolutely unnecessary. Even if they wanted to, and they don't, Russia, China, and Iran combined couldn't make a dent in NATO's military capacity. The Republican Party should be dissolved and replaced with a Freedom and Peace Party.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 48% chance that Republicans will win control of the House of Representatives in the 2024 election. They were talking about this story on the radio today, and Mike Johnson was being interviewed, and he said, you know what I want to do is I want everybody to change the normal procedure and everyone just to vote their conscience on this one. And I was thinking, wow, that's too bad that has to be a refreshing change for people in Congress to just
right.
vote the way they want.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. The U.S. resumes deportation of Haitian migrants. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by NBC News, CBS News, the Miami Herald, New York Times, and Associated Press. The Biden administration resumed deportations of migrants from Haiti on Thursday, sending dozens of people back to their home country that has been grappling with surging gang violence. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security issued a statement saying that it will continue to enforce U.S. laws and policy throughout various regions where migrants are coming, adding that it will return non-citizens who do not establish a legal basis to remain in the United States. DHS authorities did not provide further detail, but flight tracking advocacy group Witness at the Border said a plane with 74 people left from Alexandria, Louisiana, a deportation hub, and arrived in Haiti following a stopover in Miami. Deportation flights to Haiti have been delayed since DHS canceled a flight on February 29th when armed gangs attacked major airports in Port-au-Prince before raiding Haiti's two largest prisons and releasing 4,000 criminals. The last deportation took place in January, and the situation presents a political challenge as President Joe Biden faces scrutiny from both sides of the immigration debate. In late 2022, Biden granted amnesty to Haitians due to ongoing problems in the country. After gangs seized control of Haiti's institutions in recent months, hundreds of thousands have tried to flee the country, and the United Nations claims that 5.5 million Haitians need humanitarian assistance.
Scott, thanks for the facts. The progressive narrative is the first spin. It comes from The Guardian. Deporting Haitian asylum seekers back to a country that is in the midst of a humanitarian crisis is nothing short of a moral blight on the Biden administration and the U.S. as a whole. Instead of showing empathy to people fleeing a country that has been hijacked by gangs, the U.S. is callously sending them back to a place where they face persecution and a humanitarian catastrophe. Human rights must come before politics, and the Biden administration must end all deportations to Haiti.
The conservative narrative comes from Real Clear Wire. The Biden administration and left-wing nonprofits have been pushing a disastrous foreign policy agenda that has destabilized Haiti. Now the radical left is inviting thousands, if not millions, of illegal migrants into the U.S. and other countries. The situation in Haiti is a tragedy that merits our sympathy, but the U.S. cannot welcome an unending wave of Haitian migrants, especially when our southern border is being overrun by millions every year.
There is a 59% chance that Haiti will experience a civil war before 2036. That is today's nerd narrative for that story, coming from Metaculus. 108 are arrested at a Columbia University pro-Palestinian protest. Here are the facts as agreed upon by ABC News, BBC News, CNN, Associated Press, and The Guardian. Police arrested over 100 demonstrators at a pro-Palestinian protest at Columbia University on Thursday afternoon, including Isra Hirsi, the daughter of Democratic U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota. The arrests occurred as the New York Police Department, NYPD, disbanded a pro-Palestinian tent encampment constructed on the campus dedicated to demanding a ceasefire and for the university to divest from Israel financially. Columbia University President Dr. Nimat Shafik authorized the police to remove the protesters, citing safety concerns, saying in an email to students that, quote, "the individuals who established the encampment violated a long list of rules and policies." Police say that 108 people were charged with trespassing and two people were also charged with obstructing government administration. Several students involved with the protests were also suspended from Columbia and Barnard College. Thursday's arrests marked the first mass arrests on campus since the Vietnam War protests in 1968. The Columbia encampment follows similar protests across the U.S., including roadblocks at airports and major bridges. The arrest came a day after Shafik testified at a House Committee on Education and the Workforce hearing about the university's response to the allegations of anti-Semitism on campus.
Thanks, Eric. Narrative A on this story comes from the National Review. Students have a right to free speech on college campuses, but they don't have a right to disrupt learning on campus or violate their school's policies without consequences. This is not a case of Columbia censoring or unfairly targeting students with pro-Palestinian views, but rather a situation where students are being forced to deal with the consequences of their actions for violating a long list of school rules and policies and continuing their unauthorized protests, even after they were warned that they were facing arrest and suspension.
The Nation has Narrative B. Suspending students for participating in a peaceful protest is unfair and a violation of academic freedoms. These students and thousands more across the country are determined to be on the right side of history and protest against the genocide occurring in Gaza. The Apartheid Divest Coalition and other students involved with Thursday's protest will not be intimidated and will stand firm until their demands for the school to divest from Israel are met. It's very likely that more protests will be held in solidarity with those who have been wronged by Colombia.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 68% chance that Israel will have de facto power in the Gaza Strip on January 1st of 2025. Peter Murrell is charged with embezzlement in a Scottish finance probe. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Scotland Police, BBC News, STV News, The Herald, Sky News, and LBC News Scotland. Peter Murrell, former chief executive of the Scottish National Party, or SNP, and husband of former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, has been charged in connection with the embezzlement of SNP donations worth approximately £660,000, or $821,000 American dollars. Police Scotland announced, having been arrested on Thursday at 9:13 a.m., a 59-year-old man was charged at 6:35 p.m. the same day after further questioning concerning the funding and finances of the SNP. Murrell, who became SNP chief executive in 1999, stepped down from the role in March 2023, a month after Nicola Sturgeon, elected as Scotland's first minister in 2014, announced her own resignation. The two have been married since 2010. Following their resignations, both Murrell and Sturgeon were arrested in April 2023 and June 2023, respectively, in connection to the police investigation before being released without charge. A police inquiry began in July 2021 concerning alleged improper use of party donations intended for the Scottish Independence Campaign. The investigation also led to the arrest and release of former party treasurer and current member of Scottish Parliament, Colin Beattie. Reacting to the announcement, an SNP spokesperson stated that while the charge has come as a shock, the ongoing nature of the police investigation meant it would be inappropriate to comment further.
Thank you, Scott, for those facts. The first spin is Narrative A coming from Daily Record. Murrell's charges are yet another blow to the reputation and legacy of the SNP. Having pitched himself as Sturgeon's natural heir, First Minister Humza Yousaf can now only focus on damage limitation, as growing accusations of corruption cast a bleak shadow over his party. The SNP cannot be viewed as anything other than a sinking ship as the UK edges toward its next general election.
Narrative B comes from Unheard. While the charges against Murrell and the accusations against Sturgeon are shocking, the former chief executive of the SNP remains innocent until he is found guilty in a court of law. Nothing has yet been proven, and while accusations concerning the couple's professional integrity certainly need answering, conclusions cannot be drawn until the investigation is a closed case.
The nerds from Metaculus say there's a 68% chance that there will be legal consequences for Peter Murrell's involvement in the Scottish National Party's financial irregularities in the next 5 years. That's according to Metaculus. According to a recent study, 24% of UK children under 7 own smartphones. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Ofcom, The Telegraph, BBC News, The Financial Times, The Mirror, and The Times of India. According to a study published by the UK's communications regulator Ofcom on Friday, around a quarter, or 24% of British children aged between 5 and 7, have their own smartphone. Ofcom's study found that the proportion of these children using WhatsApp, Instagram, and TikTok had increased from 29% to 37%, 14% to 22%, and 25% to 30%, respectively, from a year ago. The number of this age group consuming live-streamed content online increased from 39% to 50%, while more than 40% played online games, up from 34% last year. Over half of children under 13, the minimum age limit for using WhatsApp, were active on social media platforms, while a third of 5 to 7-year-olds reportedly used social media unsupervised. The study comes as the UK government considers banning youth under 16 from accessing social media websites and teenagers from buying smartphones to make the country, quote, the safest place for children to be online. In February, the UK's Department for Education issued a comprehensive ban on children using mobile phones during school hours, reportedly to increase learning and in-person interaction.
Thanks, Eric, for those facts. The pro-establishment narrative on this story comes from The Guardian. The Ofcom study underscores the need to ban children as young as 5 from accessing social media or owning smartphones and tablets, as the practice increases their incidence of mental illness. The UK government must step up and introduce legal measures, including drawing up a safety code of practice to ensure young children are protected from sexual predators, cyberbullying, and illegal content online.
And the Telegraph has the establishment critical narrative. The fight against smartphones is neither necessary nor practical. Banning children from buying smartphones wouldn't stop parents from giving their offspring a handset. Moreover, with the advent of artificial intelligence, smartphones will become more enmeshed in every aspect of youngsters' lives. Instead of curtailing their digital rights, children must be made aware of the dangers of technology and taught how to use it safely.
And a nerd narrative on this story from Metaculus. They predict a 65% chance that more than 50% of U.S. adults will own a personal augmented reality device by 2050. And our final story comes from the world of tech as Meta releases its latest AI model and adds a free chatbot to its platforms. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by the Register, the Associated Press, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Forbes, and Daily Mail. Meta unveiled on Thursday the first two versions of its Llama 3 large language model, which the company claims can outperform much larger models, including Google's trillion-parameter Gemini Pro. The just-launched versions of the model were built with 8 billion and 70 billion parameters, a measure that indicates how much data the system is trained on. A bigger 400 billion parameter model is yet to be rolled out. This comes as several companies, including startups and established tech giants, have entered the artificial intelligence race since OpenAI launched its ChatGPT chatbot in late 2022. Llama 3 has been used to upgrade the company's smart assistant software, Meta AI, which began to be incorporated across its platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp on Thursday. Meta AI is now available in English in more than a dozen countries outside the U.S., such as Australia, Canada, Jamaica, New Zealand, Pakistan, Singapore, and South Africa. The chatbot has recently encountered issues with its responses, claiming to have a child that attends a real and very specific public school for the gifted and talented in a parenting group, and refusing to generate images of an Asian man with a white woman.
Thanks, Scott, for the facts. The first spin of this story is Narrative A coming from AI Business. As Meta has begun to launch its Llama 3-powered chatbot across apps, users will now be able to ask for restaurant recommendations and access real-time information without having to bounce to a separate page. Additionally, high-quality generated images and GIFs will be available for free, featuring a watermark label to help prevent deepfakes.
Narrative B comes from Washington Post. Given that Meta's social media platforms have long been fertile ground for misinformation and extremist content, the introduction of a chatbot can only aggravate that issue due to its tendency for hallucinations and false responses. It's not because the technology is new that its potential harm has to be accepted.
There's a 53% chance that a member of the United States Congress will introduce legislation limiting the use of LLMs in 2024. That is the nerd narrative coming from Metaculus. Thanks for listening to the Verity Podcast for Saturday, April 20th, 2024.
Each day, we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers to figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
Find out more at verity.news. You can also download the Verity app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Scott Wallace, I'm Eric Steiner, inviting you to join us next time on the Verity Podcast.